Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The world's forgotten war. I talked to director Sky Fitzgerald and correspondent Naima El-Baghir about Yemen and the starvation that could wipe out a whole generation then.
The 2010 National Humanities Medal to Philip Roth.
The life of a literary giant, the late author's official biographer, Blake Bailey, joins me to discuss Roth's writing and his complicated personal life. Plus,
he has his hands out the window. He's dressed in fatigues from the U.S. Army. He is not representing a danger to anybody.
More police outrage. The attorney for a U.S. Army officer, pepper sprayed by police in Virginia, tells Michel Martin why his client believed he could have been killed.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, and it's been a major foreign policy week for President Biden. The Japanese Prime Minister is at the White House today as the president raises Asia to top national security priority. On Thursday, the United States announced retaliatory measures against Russia for a massive cyber attack. That followed Wednesday's declaration that American troops will all soon leave Afghanistan. But an ongoing and largely ignored humanitarian crisis in Yemen could pull the U.S. back to the Middle East. There are complicated geopolitics at play between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but bearing the brunt of it all are the children. A famine is stalking Yemen, and they are literally starving to death. Nearly half a million children are at risk. It's a devastating reality for an entire generation. Hunger Ward, an Oscar-nominated documentary, looks at this through the eyes of two female healthcare workers fighting to save the lives of children in therapeutic feeding clinics. I've been speaking with the film's director, Sky Fitzgerald, and CNN's senior international correspondent, Naima El-Baghir, about Yemen's humanitarian emergency. Sky Fitzgerald, Naima El-Baghir, welcome to the program. Just give us a sense of how many lives are at stake right now with this creeping famine and the starvation.
Well, 100,000 have already died. And the recent estimates are that 400,000 more are at risk of dying by end of year if the status quo isn't altered. And that, you know, that comes to a child dying every minute and a quarter, every 75 seconds. So the scale is incredible and the crisis is real.
So you're telling me 400,000 children are at risk of dying?
Yeah, the most vulnerable amongst us. And as you know, children are the ones that, you know, bear the brunt of these conflicts most closely. And that's really what we tried to focus on in the film as well, was to show not the fighting on the front lines, but rather sort of the more insidious ways in which war is destroying an entire generation.
So let me just play a small clip, because, as I said, you focus on a nurse and a doctor in two different parts of Yemen, two different hospitals. And it is just so heart-wrenching to see them try to do what they can, and they can't save everybody. Here's a small clip.
منفصلة على الثانية كل حالة في ظروفه كان اللي جمعهم الأعراض إنهم تشابهوا سوء تغذية لكن كل حالة له خلفية وللأسف محزنة.
This is a therapeutic feeding center. What do they tell you about who they can reach and when they can't reach the desperately needy?
Well, you know, this war has really devastated an entire generation. Any child that's been born during the course of this war over the last 6+ years, you know, is at risk of starving to death. And so both Dr. Al-Sadiq and Nurse Makia are really on sort of, in their own way, the front lines of this battle to save an entire generation. And that takes it sort of plays out in many different ways. They will do anything in their power to meet the needs of every child that not only arrives on their doorstep, but when they receive a call from a family in a distant village, they'll sometimes send out one of their staffers on a moto, for example, to actually pick up that child and bring them through the multiple checkpoints for treatment, and then make sure that they receive the treatment so they can survive. Mm-hmm. So you know they're always finding a way to meet the need, no matter what the challenges are that the sort of the war places in front of them.
Let me turn to Nema, my colleague. Nema, you have covered a lot of these desperate situations. I have too. I remember the famine in Somalia before my generation was the famine in Ethiopia. They got a lot of attention, and there was intervention, certainly in Somalia, and then there was, remember, Live Aid for Ethiopia. It got a lot of world attention because of journalists and because the journalists were able to tell the story. What has been the most difficult aspect for you in today's environment of trying to tell this story?
We were refused access repeatedly by the internationally recognized government. The Saudi-backed, Saudi-led coalition is supportive of that. The US is incredibly supportive of it, and yet it was allowed to refuse us access for 8 months because of our previous reporting on the humanitarian situation on the ground and on the fact that both sides, both the internationally recognized government and Ansar Allah, the Houthis, are using their people as pawns. But it is particularly egregious when it is a government that is recognized by the global community to ban journalists' access. So we had to take extreme measures, and we had to travel into Yemen by boat in order to get in and see what was happening there.
So let me just play this clip then, because you set it up perfectly. This is you and your team on the boat.
The derelict coastline of the north of Yemen. Rusting hulks tell a story of war, blockade, and devastation. For years now, the Houthi-controlled north has been increasingly isolated from the outside world. We secretly traveled through the night by boat after our previous reporting here led the government to deny us entry.
How scary was it, Nema?
I mean, it's an awful trip. There's no way to. I mean, I think it's always a little uncomfortable to talk about these kind of things, as you know, Christiane, because we know that the situation inside for the people that we're trying to get to is so much worse. But I think it's important to state that this was not a trip that we would have taken if we had any other option. You end up having to cross the Red Sea at essentially its widest point.
I mean, it's really so scary. Let me just read what we've just heard from the IOM and UNICEF. They've confirmed that at least 16 children and 27 adults have died after a migrant ship controlled by people smugglers capsized off the coast of Djibouti. So all this sort of Red Sea area. So it is remarkably and hugely dangerous, but so necessary to tell. I just want to ask you, Skye, because this is a trilogy. This is the third of a trilogy that you have done, trying to raise awareness of great violations of humanitarian and international law, not to mention the tragedy faced by actual individuals. What are you trying to do and say in a bigger picture with these films?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think one of the things that drives me sort of has served as a catalyst for me in this entire trilogy is the fact that we currently live in a world where 1% of our population is displaced. That's almost 80 million people who can't live in their homes because of displacement due to war and other reasons, and to a great extent because of conflict. And, you know, I as a human being, as a filmmaker, I just refuse to accept that. I refuse to accept that we can't do something significant as a global community to alter that reality. And I don't think we have to accept it. So I sort of have taken it on in my own very small way as a filmmaker with my own tool set to try to bring more awareness to it and to hopefully marshal resources as well to say, listen, the fact that, you know, we're living in a world where, you know, a six-year-old girl weighs 15 pounds because there's an embargo over the country. I'm outraged by that. And so I'm trying to do these films to make people aware that, We don't have to accept that reality, nor do we have to accept the fact that our own government here in the U.S. is complicit in the fact that children are currently dying in Yemen. I refuse to accept that. So the film has become sort of a vehicle for a movement with 200 other civil society groups here in the U.S. to try to place pressure on the Biden administration to change the status quo, to withdraw unilateral support for the Saudi coalition in this current starvation of children that we're funding.
And Nema, because you've been talking and reporting about the Saudi aspect of it as well, but now we have a number of lawmakers who have written to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who are telling them, please, to tell the Saudis to lift this blockade. What is the history of America's efforts to get that blockade lifted?
Well, there is none. In fact, in the recent days, America has finally come out in line with Saudi Arabia and denied that there is a blockade. And this is in spite of the fact that in the aftermath of our reporting on the impact of the blockade, and you saw, you played what Sky was able to see inside that ward in Abs, the World Food Programme, the head of the World Food Programme, David Beasley, the UN envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths, the spokesperson for OCHA, all of them came out and said that this blockade has to be lifted. In fact, David Beasley said it would be a humanitarian act. And the United States' response is to say that there is no blockade. And it frankly beggars belief that this administration that announced with its when it came into power that human rights and U.S. foreign policy is backed, that it would choose to draw that line in the sand alongside Saudi Arabia, when everyone else in the humanitarian community, filmmakers like Sky, Democratic lawmakers, and now a bipartisan effort from the House Foreign Affairs Committee and Congress, have all come out and said the U.S. has to pressure for this blockade to be lifted.
Do you know, it's interesting, as you speak, I kind of got immediate flashbacks because the war that we covered in the, you know, in the 90s was Sarajevo, Bosnia, and that also was a blockade. It was a medieval siege that the international community did not break and did not try to break. They brought in bits and bobs of humanitarian, aid until the massacre at Srebrenica. So I guess this is a setup to ask both of you, what will it take? Do you think it takes 400,000 children, as awful as that sounds, to die of starvation, to create some kind of imperative to intervene here? Sky, you obviously want to use your film to send that message. What do you think it's going to take?
I think it takes a continuation of the movement which has already begun. So, you know, as much as this is this incredible challenge to put it on the radar of Americans and citizens of other countries which can enact change, you know, there are, I think, two things I would say. One, there is hope because this movement that has begun is real. You know, we have the 70 plus lawmakers here in the States who have signed this letter, really pressuring the Biden administration to alter course. And, you know, there are, Hollywood is paying attention. Mark Ruffalo and Judd Apatow and the journalist Nick Kristof are all sort of speaking out to say, listen, there is a blockade and we need to alter course on this. And I think we need to get stories of hope out. You know, one of the reasons that I really, you know, focus my lens on Makiya and Dr. Al-Sadiq is because, you know, they're part, you know, Mother Teresa, part Florence Nightingale. You know, they to me are just symbols of how individuals can alter the course of what's happening. So I think we should be outraged and we should be hopeful that this momentum which civil society has started can alter the outcome if we stick with it. But we need everyone to join with us.
And Nema, what gives you hope when you go there and you go into the hospitals and you also, you know, follow this terrible tragedy?
I think it's doctors and health professionals like Dr. Khalid that we met in Hodeidah who were putting their hands in their own pockets when the fuel was running out to keep the hospital running, because they know that when the generators stop because fuel has run out, it means that children die, that it means that people in those wards will stop from dying slowly through malnutrition and start dying very quickly from heat exhaustion. But I also think what gives me hope is that when people know what is happening, what is being done in their name, they tend to act. And people essentially saying, both in the US and around the world, I reject this being done in my name. And then with Sky just amazingly capitalizing on the momentum through the Oscar nomination and really just fantastically leveraging that platform to get more and more attention. And then you giving over your platform today, I just feel like the more we remind people what is being done in their name, people don't tend to let you down. People tend to speak out because nobody genuinely believes that this should be done in their name, that people should die in the name of their governments and their countries.
And actually, this pressure has actually made some effect in Congress. There's a bipartisan push to end U.S. support for the Saudi war, and Biden has pledged to end that. But also, I just want to ask you, Nema, because you've done, you know, plenty of work in Ethiopia and elsewhere. Ethiopia, there has been some terrible violations, some terrible crimes against civilians being committed. I spoke to Senator Chris Coons, a very close confidant of President Biden, who has just been to Ethiopia. Let me just play for you, Nema, what he told me.
I delivered a letter directly to him from President Biden, and I brought a letter back to President Biden from Prime Minister Abe. A couple of key developments. He made commitments about humanitarian access throughout Tigray. He made commitments and then publicly stated he recognized there have been human rights violations committed by his own troops, by Eritrean troops, by the Amhara militia, by the TPLF, and committed to an international investigation in partnership with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission.
So a lot of acronyms, obviously, a lot of different groups there at play. What do you make of the Biden administration's intercession and, you know, the voice of the president in Chris Coons going to the prime minister?
It has been largely toothless, and that is just the reality. I think that perhaps the Biden administration has not caught up quickly enough with how much the world has changed since the last time President Biden was in power, and that a lot of these violators of human rights are much more emboldened than they were the last time that President Biden was seeing the view from inside the White House, and they're not moving quickly enough to deal with a lot of these more emboldened perpetrators. We have Yemen, where they are towing the Saudi line. We now have Ethiopia, which has been going on for a good 3 months now under their watch. The whole the violence has been going on in total for 5 months. And the worry for a lot of people who are desperate for American moral leadership and American foreign policy leadership and have missed America taking that place in the world, that they're not catching up fast enough, Christiane. And we're going to there's a lot of hope still, but it is not yet really being fulfilled for a lot of people out there, frankly.
And I guess a final note then, you know, the Biden administration has signaled very directly that it is moving its focus away from the traditional places like the Middle East, Africa, away from Afghanistan, as we've seen this week, and to Asia, to China, climate, of course. Do you worry that actually even less attention might be put on a place like Yemen?
Yeah, I think it should be a concern. I think we should all sort of be keenly concerned about, given the level of complicity in our own government in the conflict over the entire course of the conflict, you know, and I think that puts a responsibility on us to make sure that we keep the pressure on.
And Nema, the news pendulum, the lens moving from where you are to Asia, to China.
Well, I think the reality is we've been here before. President Obama also signaled a strategic pivot to the East and had no choice but to focus on the Middle East and focus on the realities on the ground that imposed themselves upon him. I think President Biden will find something very similar, that if you take your eye away from these bubbling cauldrons, that eventually you'll have to come back and deal with a much bigger mess to clean up. But they may state that they are shifting, but the reality is that they are still engaging. What people are asking is for them to engage more effectively and perhaps choose their strategic allies more wisely.
And that is the case. Nema El Baghir, Sky Fitzgerald, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Two incredibly courageous and committed reporters reminding us that the lives of 400,000 children are at risk right now in Yemen. Now, the death of Philip Roth 3 years ago marked the passing of perhaps the last great American literary giant of the 20th century. His 31 books range from the ribald humor of Portnoy's Complaint to the sweeping portrait of Newark, New Jersey in American Pastoral to The Plot Against America, an alternate history of World War II, where the anti-Semitic, fascist-leaning aviation hero Charles Lindbergh becomes president. Roth's prodigious output was rivaled only by his infamous love life, which often hit the headlines. Now, a new biography, an instant New York Times bestseller, tells the definitive story of Roth's life. And so to discuss the fiction and the facts, we're joined by his official biographer, Blake Bailey. And welcome to the program. Of course, great reviews, great sales. What made you want to take on this job? Because he's a notoriously difficult person to pin down on anybody's terms but his own.
You know, I had written three previous literary biographies, and I was told that Philip had parted ways with my predecessor, Ross Miller. I had admired Philip's work all my life. I saw the opportunity, and I wrote him a letter, and he called me, and he had known Cheever. And we were talking about my three previous subjects, all of them ruinous alcoholics, and all of them safely dead. And Philip said, "Do you ever write about someone who isn't alcoholic and dead?" And I said, "Not yet. You would be my first." So we got together and talked about it, and we hit it off.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like certainly from that story. And he clearly liked and respected you. I mean, I think it took you about a decade or so to do it. But in a documentary in 2014, he said that, you know, you were tireless, you were prodigious, and you interviewed everybody and went straight for the jugular. Let's just listen to his voice talking about you.
So Blake thinks it'll take him till the year 2022, I think he said. And we had talked about this. I said, "You know, I'll do anything for you, but I don't know if I can stay alive till 20. I'll do my best to stay alive till 2020, but don't push me over the top, you know." So he's going to, it'll be published after my death.
Was that an issue for him? I mean, clearly you were right. He was right. He wasn't going to survive until the publication. How much of an issue was that for him?
The fact that he would not be alive when I was done. When we first met in 2012, Philip had recently, I mean, from the age of 49, he had been diagnosed with coronary artery disease. And he had a quintuple bypass in 1989. And he was still alive in 2012 because Philip just had an incredibly rigorous discipline of exercise and seeing doctors the way he should and so forth. But he had recently been upgraded to congestive heart failure. So he said, "You know, I've got about a year. And we're going to sit down, we're going to have a lot of interviews, I'm going to give you everything I got, and then I'll get out of your way." And I said, "Well, you seem pretty sprightly to me. I think you'll be around for a while." And sure enough, you know, year passed into year passed into year, and Philip wasn't going anywhere. And I think he began, I mean, that BBC interview, that was It was taped in late 2013, and Philip finally died in May 2018. But I think there toward the end, he was really scrappily trying to hang on, because our agreement was that he would get to vet my manuscript for factual accuracy. And I think that that was a task that Philip keenly welcomed.
It's amazing. And to his fiction now, he obviously was a hugely prolific and hugely influential author. In 2004, he reflected, "I don't really have other interests. My interest is in solving the problems presented by writing a book. That's what stops my brain spinning like a car wheel in the snow, obsessing about nothing." So is it fair to call him and obsessive. He was certainly a control freak, if I can use that dreadful word. You know, he liked to, I mean, he even ghost wrote his own plaque, right, in New Jersey or in Newark that they put up for him. How did you find that desperation to control? I know he said, here it is and off you go. But was he obsessive?
He was extremely obsessive, yes. And his obsessions were rather static and predictable. I probably received a total of, I don't know, 15 to 20 memos on the subject, and some of them were quite long. I mean, like 10 single space type pages about his being deceived and almost destroyed by his first wife, Maggie. Maggie was a woman with a lot of problems. She was 5 years older than he was. She had two disturbed children who were almost illiterate. And finally, one day, and Philip had been trying to get rid of her for a long time, he discovered that she just pawned his typewriter. So she said, he said, Maggie, you have to go. And Maggie said, I can't, I'm pregnant. And he said, prove it, and gave her a jar. And she took the jar to Tompkins Square Park and found an obviously pregnant woman and paid $2 or $3 for her urine so she could establish she was pregnant. And Philip married her, and it almost destroyed his life in many ways. So Philip, not an hour of his life passed until he died at age 85 that he didn't brood about Maggie. And whenever he brooded about something, which was constantly, he'd write me a memo about it. So that's pretty obsessive.
Wow, that is obsessive. I mean, that really is, especially to obsess over somebody who caused him so much heartache. And we know, of course, that his later wife, Claire Bloom, the British actress, wrote a pretty scathing denunciation of him and their time together. And she, you know, portrayed it in the, you know, the lens of misogyny and emotional cruelty. And obviously the elephant in the room, and I'd love you to talk about this, is his treatment of women and his apparently dysfunctional relationship with so many of them. Talk to me about that.
Well, it needs to be put in perspective. I mean, Philip's dysfunctional relationship with so many women, that's not really true. He had dysfunctional relationships with the two women he married. And we should perhaps, in fairness, bear in mind that Philip did not want to get married ever to anybody and was cornered into those two marriages. Same deal with Claire, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But he had many healthy relationships. He had a 5 or 6 year relationship with Ann Mudge in the 60s, followed by a 5 or 6 year relationship with Barbara Sproul, who ended up dumping Philip, not vice versa. And in both cases, they remained lifelong friends. Both those women and several others were at Philip's bedside when he was dying. Ann Mudge was 86 at the time and needed a helper to get there. And I was there. I saw it. Philip was loved dearly by many women who had been his lovers. In the case of Claire, you know, she has certainly legitimate grievances. Philip did not have a monogamous bone in his body. He was rampantly unfaithful to her. That's very painful to learn. He had a partner concurrent with almost the entire 20 years that he was with Claire, the woman I call Inga in my book, who is the model for the insatiable Drenka in Sabbath's theater. And finally, you know, he very abruptly and hurtfully abandoned Claire. And so she wrote the book she wrote. But so all that's true, and all that is quite damning. And certainly Philip was quite capable of sexually objectifying women and making incredibly tasteless jokes about it, many of which he put into his books, especially Sabbath Theater and Portnoy. But he was not, as Claire characterizes him, this sinister Machiavellian misogynist, you know, bent on persecuting her and her daughter Anna. And indeed, once Claire was finished doing the media stuff for Leaving a Doll's House, she went back to saying constantly in public interviews that her relationship with Philip Roth was the best relationship of her life.
Wow. It's complicated. And listen, you're right. And I want to give you and him his due. It is an extraordinary story that so many of his lovers were at his bedside. And actually, I spoke to one of them, the poet Mary Carr, who talked to me in the aftermath of his death in 2018 and addressed the very question I asked you. And this is what she said.
All these women, all these former lovers were at his deathbed. I want to say there were five women there. Not one of them was this sort of sniveling masochist. There was a doctor. There was a woman who ran a theology department. There was a woman who ran a quite vast horse farm in Virginia who was had been older than him than he when they were involved. I mean, if you spend some weeks in a hospital with people, you get to know them. And their affection for him was pretty undiluted.
So she wasn't his lover, she was his friend, but she, you know, she's saying what you said. You said that you talked to him, or he and you had a conversation about the Me Too moment, which obviously broke a year before he died. What were his reflections about that?
We never had a conversation about Me Too per se. I quote him writing to his friend Bernie Abishai, and he was very rattled by Me Too. For one thing, he had made a very unseemly pass at the best friend of his, you know, of Claire Bloom's daughter, Anna Steiger. I called Anna Steiger's friend Felicity in my book, and he was terrified that she would. He didn't do anything illegal, but it was just unseemly. And he was afraid that she would come forward with some public exaggeration of what had happened. Again, it would just be embarrassing and humiliating to say what actually happened. He worried that there might be some exaggeration involved. And the whole thing just scared him. I mean, he was scared. He knew that he brought a certain amount of scrutiny in that respect on himself, and that he was going to be in for it. The way that transpired between us was that Philip became much more skittish in our conversations and much more sort of circumspect, because earlier in our relationship, Philip would tell me anything. I mean, he would tell me ribald anecdotes about him and various women in his life. I mean, he loved talking about that stuff. And I mean, though I say it myself, he was pretty funny about it often. But yeah, I mean, and he also very much worried about what woman I call Inga was going to tell me, had told me.
Yeah, let me ask you, though, in the end about, you know, his incredible, prolific and influential legacy of writing, going from Portnoy's Complaint. He was very self-referential in many of his books at the beginning. But then, you know, American Pastoral and The Human Stain, The Plot Against America were giants. What will his legacy be?
Well, I mean, for my money, you know, there are among the great Jewish writers of the 20th century in America, there's Saul Bellow, there's Bernard Malamud, there's Norman Mailer, and there's Philip Roth. And I'm a great admirer, particularly of Bellow. But I think Bellow and Malamud and Mailer, their work at least, seems to be going somewhat into eclipse. I certainly hope that will reverse itself at some point. I think Philip, you know, is the greatest chronicler of the American Jewish experience of the post-war era. And I think it would be a shame if he became unfashionable or was even canceled. Because, you know, I mean, of the 31 books he published, some are absolutely essential reading, if you're a reader and if you care about such things. I mean, his first book, Goodbye Columbus, in 1959, won him the National Book Award when he was 26. Portnoy's Complaint, 10 years later, is on the Modern Library list of the 100 greatest English language novels of all time. And lastly, in 2006, the New York Times canvassed 200 critics, scholars, and writers to name the best American novel of the past 25 years. Of the final list of 22 books, 6 were by Philip Roth. And those 25 years were less than half of his overall career.
That's amazing, really. It really is. And you're right. He is the definitive chronicler of American Jewish life. Thank you so much indeed for joining us. Meanwhile, pressure is now mounting on President Biden and Congress to commit to holding police officers accountable for misconduct. This comes as newly released body cam footage of the fatal police shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo in Chicago on March 29th raises significant questions about the official version of events. Yet another controversial encounter occurred in Virginia in December when two police officers pointed guns at and pepper sprayed Army Second Lieutenant Karen Nazario during a traffic stop. Nazario is suing the two police officers for $1 million in damages. Here's our Michelle Martin talking to his lawyer, Thomas Roberts.
Thank you, Christiane. Thomas Roberts, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are representing Lieutenant Karen Nazario in his action. You and your firm are representing him in his complaint against the Windsor, Virginia Police Department, specifically the two officers who pulled him over, and the department on the whole, I would assume. We're going to play some very disturbing video of this encounter. This just emerged. This incident happened in December, but this just emerged this week, and it's caused a lot of attention, as you might imagine. We're not going to play the entirety of the encounter, but we are going to play a relevant portion of it, and here it is.
Get out of the car now! Get out of the car now! Get out of the car!
Sir, just get out of the car! Work with us and we'll talk to you! Get out of the car!
You received our order! Obey it!
I'm honestly afraid to get out. Can I?
Yeah, you should be. Get out!
What?
Get out!
Get out of the car!
Get out now!
I have not committed any crime.
You're being stopped for a traffic violation. You're not cooperating at this point right now. You're under arrest for you're being detained, okay? You're being detained for obstruction of justice.
Traffic violation. I do not have to get out the vehicle. You haven't even told
really?
Me why I'm being stopped.
Really?
Get
out of the car now. Get out of the car.
Get your hands off me.
Get out of the car.
Get your hands off me.
You know what?
Get your hands off me.
Not
get
a problem.
Your hands off me.
Back up, Daniel.
I didn't do anything. Don't do that. I'm actively serving this country, and this is how you're going to treat me?
Back up, Daniel.
I didn't do anything.
Back up.
Whoa, hold on.
Daniel.
What's going on? Hold on. Watch. Watch it.
Mr. Roberts, you're aware of the reaction that this has caused around the country when the public first saw this. I'd like to ask you how you reacted when you first saw this.
With horror. We saw this first through the eye of Lieutenant Nazario's camera, and it caused us concern. We wanted to get all angles before we took any action, so we obtained the body cam footage, and when we saw that, it confirmed our worst fear.
Well, what is your worst fear, and what did you see when you saw this, especially when you saw the incident in its totality? What do you see here?
In its totality, what you first have to see is that when he was lit up from the body cam, you can see that he immediately showed that he was complying by slowing down. At one point in time, he had slowed down to 18 miles an hour, and he moved to the closest lit place, which was in sight, and pulled over and stopped his car, rolled his windows down. And although this clip didn't start there, the very first commands that came out were keep your hands out of the window. And throughout this clip, you see that that's exactly what he did. He kept his hands out of the window. And he kept them out because he feared. Why did he fear? Because when he stopped, he saw in his mirror on the side that the first thing that happened is they came out with guns drawn, pointed at him. He was concerned that he was going to die, that something volatile was happening, something wasn't right. And so he turned his camera on at that point in time, had his hands outside of the window and kept them there. Now, the commands were conflicting. How do you keep your hands outside the window and get out of the car? He chose to obey the first command and kept those hands out throughout the entire incident.
Did they say why they tried to pull him over to begin with? Did that ever, I understand we aren't seeing this video in its totality. It goes on for you know, some few minutes. Did they ever tell him directly why they say they pulled him over?
Throughout the time that he was asking what's going on, they did not. Later in the video and also in the police reports, that's what we have discerned, is that it all dealt with that there was not a license plate at the bumper where you normally see one. But again, that issue was clarified when they pulled in behind him and followed him at a slow rate of speed and got to the lit area of the BP station. And you could see that the reason for stopping him disappeared, and that should have been the end of it. But the law makes it very clear when you're talking about reasonable force under Graham, you know, you look at every instance and you don't look at it, you know, sitting in the you know, Monday night quarterback. It's from the officer's perspective and it's supposed to be an objective view. But you look at the severity of the crime. In this case, there was no severe crime. You look at whether or not he's posing a danger to the officers or others. He has his hands out the window. He's dressed in fatigues from the U.S. Army. He is not representing a danger to anybody. His hands are clearly in a I give up, I'm complying mode. I hear people saying, well, he should have gotten out of the car. In the clip that you showed, you heard many times, get out of the car. But in order to get out of the car, what would he have to do? He would have to take his hand and move it into the dark car, even though it's lit, you know, you can't see where it's moving it. And in this case, this young officer had a legal firearm near the seatbelt. It was a concealed weapon. It was lawful. He had every right to have it there. But the last thing he would want to do is reach in the vicinity of a firearm when you have two guns pointed at you. Had he done that and they shot him, we'd probably be hearing a different story. A different narrative would be, young man reached for a firearm, shot, officer's a hero.
You hear Lieutenant Nazario say, I'm afraid to get out of the car.
Yes.
And then you hear Officer Gutierrez say, you should be. You should be. How do you interpret that?
I think everybody interprets it the correct way. When he was asking what's going on, Lieutenant Gutierrez, he responds, what's going on? You're about to ride the light. You're fixing to ride the lightning, son. Now,
what does that mean?
You have two people, you know, you have Gutierrez, whatever he intended it to mean, and you have Lieutenant Nazario. I believe, first and foremost, it meant that you were about to experience violence.
Is there any circumstance in which you think that's an appropriate thing to say after a traffic stop or during a traffic stop?
What it did is it confirmed that Lieutenant Nazario was reasonable in his belief that he was about to be injured or killed. He's saying, I'm fearing because of the prior statement you made, I legitimately fear, and you've got two guns pointed at me. I fear for my life. I'm afraid to get out. And the officer confirms that and says, you should be. It's despicable.
The police chief of the Windsor Department, Rodney Riddle, has finally spoken about this. He spoke about this on Wednesday of this week, and he insisted that Second Lieutenant Nazario, quote unquote, created the tense situation by failing to respond immediately on the night of December 5th when the police car flashes lights to pull him over. And so how do you react to that?
First of all, if you listen to the tape, the officers themselves dispel the chief's statement. And I find the statement to be disingenuous for the following reason. The officers admitted on the videotape later, as he's in handcuffs, they say, yes, you know, happens all the time. People don't stop on the dark road and drive to a lit area. If it happens all the time, as they said, how is driving 18 miles an hour failing to obey?
So let me just say this. The chief says that the situation in totality is Lieutenant Nazario's fault. But he did fire Officer Gutierrez, who pepper sprayed Lieutenant Nazario in the face. And you can hear screaming at him and saying falsely that he is that he's under arrest, which he isn't. Does that change anything for you?
What's disturbing about the statement by the chief of police is, first of all, the chief of police showed up there that night. And secondly, as I understand it, we're going to be looking, investigating further, but the history between Officer Gutierrez and the chief is, from what I understand, a long history. After the meeting that Gutierrez had with the chief, there's a clip portion that you should find extremely disturbing, because in that clip, it appears that Officer Gutierrez is trying to convince Lieutenant Nazario that he's the one that's responsible for this incident. And he's walking through a false narrative on the tape. And then it gets worse when he says, you know, I know, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, but I know, you know, it's your right to make something up, this, to speak out. But if you let it go, we're going to let you go, while he's got the man in handcuffs.
The chief's giving me discretion on how to handle it. He's like, these are the two choices. I said, that's what I was thinking. That's what I want to do. He's like, not a problem. We can either let it go, help him out, get his eyes back, and get him on down the road so the Army doesn't get involved, or we can charge you, and then it's a big hassle for you. It doesn't change my life one way or the way.
I don't know how to interpret that other than saying, you know, you shut up, you keep it quiet, and we're not going to charge you with the crime. We have words for that. It's called extortion. This is wrong. You can't do that.
At the moment you and I are speaking, there has been another killing of an unarmed individual in Minnesota. Former police officer Derek Chauvin is on trial in the death of George Floyd, with also video evidence that has now gone viral internationally. This has been seen all around the world. What do you think about this particular case that people find so disturbing? What is it that you think the public is reacting to here?
I'm seeing an overwhelming response from some of the leadership. There's a corner that's missing. Many of my Democratic friends have spoken out, but in the conservative circles, there's complete silence. Mm-hmm. Among the population, not so. Among the leaders, silence. I think they're afraid, because it's yet another Black man, that they're not going to speak out. That's wrong. Justice is for everybody, irrespective of the color of your skin. And I tell people, you know, we take cases, whether you're white, whether you're Black, we take your cases. But the unfortunate reality is that so many of our cases are cases involving minorities, people of color. That's a sad reality. And conservatives have got to get their head out of the sand and say, this is a problem, and it affects minorities in a way that it shouldn't. It's too much on the minority community.
Why does this bother you so much that you're not hearing from conservatives expressing outrage about this?
It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. I'm a conservative because of the views that I hold. I hold the views that all men are created equal. I hold the views that government and the force of government should be restrained by a constitution. Traditionally, that was a conservative view. And there was a time when liberals and conservatives could meet on some essential elements, like the First Amendment, you know, the right to speak. Mm-hmm. People used to say, you know, I may disagree with you, but I will defend your right to speak. I will die for your right to speak. We've lost that in this country.
What do you think should happen now? Or what does Lieutenant Nazario think should happen now?
Well, first thing, giving an individual a shield or a badge and a gun is a responsibility. It's an honor and a responsibility. If you're not able or you're not willing to live up to that responsibility, get out of the force. And I say to officers, if you see a fellow officer that's unwilling or unable to live up to that responsibility, don't tarnish your name by standing there doing nothing. You need to intervene. You need to say, we are subject to the law, and you may not violate the law by using excessive force on this man. And you may not cover up a matter by writing something in your report that is inconsistent with the facts. There are good officers, and those officers should be the ones standing up and saying, no more, this has to stop. Because it ruins their reputation.
You seem, forgive me for, obviously we are here to talk about Lieutenant Nazario, you're here as his representative, but you seem very upset. And I just wanted to ask, like, what is this bringing up for you?
I love this country, and I know a lot of people do. I love this country because of the people in it, and I love this country because the way that it was set up, there were ideals. The nation has not lived up to those ideals, but it's a nation that began with ideals. And our struggle that we have today is to continue to rise to the ideals. You know, acknowledge we failed.
Do you think that Lieutenant Nazario would have been treated the same way if he were white?
In this case, I don't believe so. And the reason I say it in this case, because the officers acknowledged that first of all, it happens all the time that people go travel to this lit area. And secondly, they acknowledge that 80% of the time, it's people of color who do that. And so coming out guns drawn, I think in this case, has to be based upon what they've told us was in their mind.
But what does that mean? I mean, it would seem to me that maybe that means that the people of color pull over to a well-lit area because they are afraid of them.
And
I mean, isn't that the logical implication of that?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's nothing unreasonable about that fear given what we've seen in the last 10 years.
You know that people, the chief has said in his remarks earlier this week that this was a training issue. And he said that as we've said, he fired one officer, but he also said that the other officer, Officer Crocker, who you've seen, the younger officer who we heard in that earlier clip, has the makings of an officer. Is this a training issue or is this something else?
I'm going to answer that question by saying, look at his report. How do you train honesty? Character is a virtue that I think that you don't just train. It's part of the person. It's part of the long makeup. And when you have an officer that writes in a report things that don't match what actually happened, that's a character problem. That's a character issue. That's not a training issue.
What does justice for Lieutenant Nazario look like in this case? And could you be more specific and tell us what specifically your lawsuit asks for?
Justice in this case is to hold the officers accountable. And the only way that we can do that in the lawsuit is to ask for money damages. Those money damages include compensatory damages to compensate him for the agony, for the mental stress that he experienced and will continue to experience. This is not going to go away in his mind, this event, where he thought he was going to die as like a dog on the street as they're putting him down on the ground. He was like, no, you know, that compensation is one that a jury of his peers in the Norfolk federal court will decide, you know, how do you put a salve over this injury? The other part of that is punitive damages. We've asked that the jury in this case, we will ask them to do two things, to punish the offenders, and not only that, but to award what's called exemplary damages. Exemplary damages are to make a statement loud enough for people to hear as a warning to other officers that if you do this sort of conduct, you will be punished. This has to stop. And so that is what justice looks like for Lieutenant Nazario.
Thomas Roberts, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for your interest and insights. Thank you very much.
And just to reiterate, the program did contact the Windsor Police Department for comment, and a spokesperson said one of the police officers involved was fired. And finally, this Saturday, the British royal family will lay their patriarch to rest as millions tune in to watch the funeral of Prince Philip, partner of Queen Elizabeth for more than 70 years. It's set to be less grand and more of a family affair since the pandemic has slimmed down the guest list from 800 to just 30 people. The House of Windsor has spent this week rehearsing, revealing this custom Land Rover that was designed by the Prince himself and which will carry his coffin to St. George's Chapel. You can join me tomorrow for CNN's special coverage of this event. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.